I didn't know we were live. All right. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 9:35. The date is Wednesday, March 7th, 2018. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyert, Deputy Secretary of State, on behalf of Wayne Williams, Glenn Roper, Assistant Solicitor General, Designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Julie Pellegrin, Designee of Office of Legislative Legal Services. Also to my far right is our staff from the Attorney General's office, Matt Grove, and to my far left is Steve Ward, the Title Board Manager Extraordinaire. I don't know what your title is. Sorry, clerk. There are two titles for each measure. One is a statement and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the Title Board to the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. For anyone who wishes to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the Title Board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow three steps. First, the board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure the board understands the proposal. Then the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-4106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the measure is a constitutional change, the board will consider under CRS 140-106 whether the measure only repeals in whole or in part a provision of the state constitution. Third, if the board determines that it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we take all testimony first, then the board will discuss and vote after all testimony is completed. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Please take note we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set titles or to the correctness of the titles and summaries themselves. Anyone who's dissatisfied with the decision of the Title Board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. The first item on the agenda today is 2017-2018, number 126. This is a rehearing on payday loans. And Mr. Dunn, I believe you filed the motion.
I did. Good morning, members of the board, manager extraordinaire. And Mr. Groves. Can't forget him. thank you for your time today. So you have our motion for rehearing. I'm here on behalf of Bill Fritz, objector. We have generally four categories of objections. Initial jurisdictional issue, a single subject objection, concerns about the fiscal impact statement and abstract, and then should we get there on the title as well. So let me start with the initial jurisdictional issue. And I believe you have in your packets copies of the original, amended, and final versions of the measure. If I could ask you to turn to the original version, because this is a little bit technical. If you look at Section 4 of the measure, this is 5.3.1.121. I'll give you a minute to get there. And if you look at the changes, in the original version, let me read what it says in the original version. Under 5.3.1.121.2, it says, a person violates the requirements of this article by engaging in any act that limits or restricts the application of this article, and this is the important part, comma, including making loans disguised as personal property, sale and lease back transactions, et cetera. And that's the language I want to focus on. So if you look at what the proponents changed in that, in their original version, they, on what I think is line of that paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, they struck the S and the comma on sales as well as the S on transactions. In the review and comment memorandum, legislative counsel raised the issue that as a technical matter, the preferred form is to strike an entire word and then retype it in the singular in small caps. That was raised at the hearing, and they said they would do that. So if you look at the final version of what they submitted, they went beyond that. So what it says now, after that comma in line 3, they made some changes prior to that that aren't relevant here, It says, including making loans disguised as a personal property sale, comma, and leaseback transaction. Now, what that does is change the type of transactions that are subject to the unfair and deceptive trade practice element of the Deferred Deposit Loan Act. And under the original version, a personal sale and leaseback transaction is a term of art, and it's a very specific type of transaction. Essentially, what it is a transaction in which a person, they don't physically bring in personal property, they usually bring a serial number. They go into a lender and they agree to transfer ownership of an item to that lender by giving them the serial number. And then and with that, they give them usually a check that's post-dated, and along with that, a separate check that is a fee for leasing back their own item that they didn't bring in the first place. So say, for example, they need a $200 loan. They will write a $200 check to the lender that's held. They will also write a check for $60, let's say, that constitutes the lease on their own item that they have transferred ownership to and then lease back. And then they have the right to repurchase their consumer good at a given date, usually 2 weeks out, for the price of the loan. So when they come back in, they pay back the $200, or they repurchase the product, and then essentially the interest is the $60 that they paid on the for the lease back on the item. So it's sort of a roundabout way of getting a $200 loan and paying $60 for it. It's a very specific thing that relates to consumer items in a personal sale and lease back transaction, which is what the statute referred to. Now it simply just says it refers to loans disguised as a personal property. I'm not quite sure what that means, but then it says sale. Not really sure what that means, comma, and lease back transaction. So a leaseback transaction is different than a personal sale and leaseback. So it's changed the nature of what is considered unfair and deceptive trade practices under the Act, which by the proponent's own statement, the single subject of the measure, and this ties into our single subject argument, but it's also changes that go beyond the review and comment memo and what was discussed at the review and comment hearing. So we think the board lacks jurisdiction based on the substantive change that was made. And it also constitutes a second subject. The stated single subject of the measure was to change charges applicable under the Act, but it goes beyond that because it changes the types of transactions that will constitute unfair and deceptive trade practices. So that's both our jurisdictional arguments on both the review and comment memo and the single subject argument. On the fiscal impact statement, I think you have that. And do you want to pause there, or do you want to keep going?
Yeah, let's do the jurisdictional part first, and then we'll go to, if we get there, we'll go to the.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. Title manager extraordinaire. Like that.
Don't forget Mr.
Mr. Grove. Mr. Grove. Mr. Grove. Martha Tierney, on behalf of the proponents who are both present here, Corinne Fowler and Reverend Dr. Annie Rice Jones, and they already signed their affidavits at the original hearing. I am not sure I understand Mr. Dunn's argument, because what I'm looking at, all we changed was the plural to the singular, and we took out personal in the first version. So now it says a personal property sale, because there's no comma after property. That was taken out. And leaseback transaction. So there are no substantive changes from the original to the final. And the only changes were to take out the plural there to clean it up a little. And we were told in review and comment that the proper drafting technique was to not strike the S, but to strike the whole word. And then if you'll recall, Ms. Pellegrin at our first hearing pointed out that we didn't leave the original language in there, and it was again a drafting issue that we fixed during the hearing. So there are no substantive changes. So Mr. Dunn, maybe you could help me. I mean, look.
I will correct one thing. She's right on the first comma there. It does say a personal property sale. But then there's an extra comma in there that changed it from a personal sale and leaseback transaction to a sale, comma, and leaseback transaction.
So is your argument, Mr. Dunn, about the comma?
My comment is about the substantive change that creates, and that is beyond the review and comment.
But it is in the original version.
Well, so, the comma is not after sale, right? Or no, it is.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. There are no changes from the original version on that point.
Well, when you say the original, do you mean the statute?
No, the one that we submitted to review and comments, because your jurisdiction is based on changes we might make between the original and the final.
So as I look at your original, it strikes the word S and the comma and in then, sales.
And then your final doesn't strike the comma.
Okay. I don't think that first one was intended to be, that first comma was intended to be stricken. It was supposed to be striking the S. But I would submit to you that that is not a substantive change that would deprive this body of jurisdiction.
And looking at the original, I mean, I can see why you may have intended to strike the S, because it would be saying a personal property sale and the leaseback transaction, which could be two things and you wouldn't need a comma because you were getting rid of the third. Because the original, the statute is personal property, comma, personal sales, comma, and leaseback transactions. And so in the original, if you were going to a personal property sale and leaseback transaction. Correct. That could be, I mean, maybe it's ambiguous as to whether that's one thing or two things, but either way, I agree that having a comma after sale or not, I don't think substantively changes the meaning. Because then what we received as the final is still gonna say a personal sale, comma, and leaseback transaction.
A personal property sale.
Yes, personal property sale.
Yeah, I don't know that it changes either. I just want to make sure that the intent is to have the comma.
The intent is to have the final. Comma. Yep.
So that's not a Scrivener's error.
No.
The intent is to have the comma.
Yes.
Okay. And Mr. Dunn, what are you saying that does that's different to have the comma there, or are you just saying that was not in response to the review and comment?
I'm saying it substantially changes the type of a transaction that's now covered by the unfair and deceptive trade practices provision of the act, which was not part of the proponent's stated single subject, because a personal sale and leaseback transaction is a very specific term of art in the lending world, and it's meant to cover a very specific type of transaction, and this changes that.
So in the statute without the proposed amendment, it refers to just a leaseback transaction, right?
Are you talking about as law exists today?
Yes.
So it says it refers to, I believe, a personal property as personal property, comma, sale and leaseback transactions.
I think the way it reads right now, it's personal property, comma,
yep.
Personal sales, comma,
sorry, you're
and
correct.
Leaseback yeah. Transaction, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. So then I think if I'm understanding the argument, it's that when they submitted their original text, it was a personal property sale and leaseback transaction. So it was this one kind of thing that he's saying is the specified thing. And then when you changed it from the to the final version, it became a separate thing instead of the same transaction, right?
Well, I would characterize it as a error in omitting a comma.
In the original?
Yes.
And is there something in review and comment that would have allowed you to make that change? Where you put the comma back in?
The review and comment is addressing the plural and where we amended the plural. There is no discussion in the review and comment about whether that creates a separate item. And I think based on what Mr. Dunn just conceded, because the original language says personal property, personal sale, comma, and leaseback transaction, that we really aren't changing that. It wasn't in the original statute a personal sale and leaseback transaction. It was a personal sale, comma, and leaseback transaction.
So what would that mean if the initiative were to pass? Just the phrase, making loans disguised as a personal property sale, comma, and leaseback transaction. Just grammatically, I'm not quite sure I understand what that is saying. Is it saying loans disguised as one thing or two things?
I think they could be two things. So if you think of it in the, oftentimes, as I understand it, payday lenders will accept a piece of property as collateral, if you will, for the loan, and could be disguised in that way as not a payday loan, but a personal property loan. And then you lease it back. You can, in some situations, lease back that property by paying installments, which is a different type of loan, not a payday loan. And so the measure is intended, and originally also intended in the original statute, to not allow people making payday loans to not be covered by this statute because they are couching them as personal sale and or leaseback transactions.
So a separate question. In the final, it doesn't seem to show the strikeout of the S in sales and the S in transactions.
That's what we fixed.
Right, we're going back to this.
Okay, that's right. I recall that now. I just want to.
Yeah. But we didn't fix the, we didn't do anything.
There was
with
nothing
the
with a comma.
Right.
Okay.
What's the proponent's intent in taking out, what's going to be the effective change in the law by taking out that second personal? By instead of having personal property and personal sale, to just have personal property sale. What's the effect of that?
The language as it is written now means the same thing. It is just a clearer way to say it.
So you're not intending any substantive change?
No.
So Mr. Dunn indicated there may be something called a sale and leaseback transaction.
He did, but then he's conceded that the original language has a comma between sale and and leaseback transactions, so that now this wouldn't change that.
Right,
if it originally meant sale, comma, and leaseback transaction, it still means that.
Well, and I think that would be good for the single subject argument, but I think his point is that you submitted something different than what you did in your final version because of that comma. I think that's...
And so our position is that we didn't, that it's not different in that sense other than a comma. It has no substantive change.
But doesn't it, if there's something that's called a sale and leaseback transaction?
But,
right.
But if it was called that, Madam Chair, in the original statute, it's still that. It still has the same comma that it had.
Right. I guess the question is, with your original, did you propose changing it to something else called a sale and leaseback transaction, which I don't know if there is such a thing or not. And then with the final, did you remove that change and bring it back to be in line with the statute as it currently stands? Do you understand my question?
I do, but I'm getting frustrated.
Well, I apologize.
We did not intend to make a substantive change to a item that I don't know exists called a sale and leaseback transaction, different from what was already in the statute, sale, comma, and leaseback transaction.
Okay. And Mr. Dunn, you're saying there's something specifically that's a sale and leaseback transaction that's different than a sale, comma, leaseback transaction.
Correct. Okay. And I probably should have been more clear, right? So Mr. Roper said it better than I did, that she's correct about the comma in the original statute. Then there was a change made in the original version of the submittal, and then it was changed back.
And can you explain the difference between, and maybe you did and I didn't get it then, but the difference between a sale and leaseback transaction versus a sale or a leaseback transaction?
I think one is a subset of the other. So a personal sale and leaseback transaction, it relates to a consumer good. So it's, as I said, it's when a person brings in theory, their stereo or their TV and in order to obtain a loan. A leaseback transaction is a much broader instrument that typically is used in the context of real estate. So someone may sell their real estate and then lease it back. I think the state is pretty good at that, actually, doing that. So it's a much more broad type of transaction than personal sale and leaseback transactions.
All right. Anyone have any other questions on it?
No.
Just to make sure I'm understanding. The way the original came in, it would have been a personal property sale and leaseback transaction, which is what you're saying is one thing. That's what the original says. Without the comma, it would be
Correct.
Personal property sale and leaseback transaction.
I think the original version said loans disguised as a personal property sale. Yes, and leaseback transaction.
So one, just
right.
Arguably one thing, personal
Correct.
Property and sale leaseback. And so with the comma, now it's arguably two things, personal property sale and a leaseback transaction. Although it still sounds like it's a singular thing because it's a personal property sale, even though there's a comma, and leaseback transaction, it still sounds like it's disguised as this one thing. So I'm really struggling to figure out whether it's a comma or not a comma is substantial.
Let me ask Ms. Tierney, if the original had not been changed so that there was no comma, could you have proposed that as a Scrivener's error to get the comma added back in, if that really was the intent, in the before the title board? Does that make sense?
Yes, I think we could have. And I can propose it now if you'd like.
Well, I don't think you need to propose anything. It's just if the intent was for there to be a comma, and the original accidentally omitted it, and I guess I'm kind of thinking out loud here, that seems like possibly the kind of thing we could have dealt with here in Title Board, which leads me to think this isn't a substantive change that would deprive us of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. I do have some concern about whether there is this thing called a sale and leaseback transaction. I looked through the review and comment memo, and I don't see anything discussing that one way or another. But my inclination would be to not consider that the change to the comma to be a substantive change, not in response to review and comment, that would deprive us of jurisdiction.
I agree.
Okay.
Mr. Dunn, excuse me, Madam Chair, Mr. Dunn made some arguments on single subject. Do you want me to go there, or do you want to deal with this issue first?
Yeah, let's do single subject, and then that way we can just do a motion on jurisdiction after.
Okay. The argument is that the Section 4 language creates a separate subject. And we would submit to you, first of all, that the title that was set eliminates that problem. If the title now, it says that the single subject clause has limitations on the charges imposed by payday lenders. So that's the staff draft. Now it says limitations on payday lenders, which would include the Section 4 language. But even without that, the Section 4 language is enforcement, implementation of the 36% cap. It is directing, it is how the measure seeks to require payday lenders to comply with the subject of the measure. It is an implementation enforcement element that flows directly from the single subject of the measure. But if the single subject of the measure, as this board has determined, is limitations on payday lenders, there is no single subject problem regardless. The Section 4 language implements the cap by delineating what constitutes behavior intended to evade the cap. It goes to implementation and enforcement.
Mr. Dunn, do you have any response you want to make?
Thank you. I'd say two things. One is, as you all know, a title can't cure a single subject problem. But second, I would say that Section 4 goes beyond just enforcing the rate cap, right? It talks about engaging the new language in engaging in any device, subterfuge, or pretense to evade the requirements of this article, any requirement of the article. So it is much more broad than just pertaining to the rate cap, which is the supposed single subject of the measure.
So the second subject you listed in your motion is changing the types of loan transactions that constitute unfair or deceptive practices. Was that a reference to the sale and leaseback transaction issue?
It is, but also to the previous language in the all caps language that makes it applicable to not just the interest rate, but any type of action that would constitute a violation of any of the provisions of the Deferred Deposit Loan Act.
Which include what other types of things?
Disclosures, ability, cancellation rights. I'm sure there's others.
Okay. All right, any questions for? Oh, go ahead.
Just on that point, though, the disclosures and the cancellation rights all go to the payday loan. So it is all the same subject about, and what a payday loan is a loan that comes with fees associated with it. So I think it is all, and that article, Title V, Article 3.1, all it is about is payday loans. It's not broader. It doesn't have to do with other types of loans or other types of financial transactions.
All right. Any comments? Or you want to make a motion?
Yeah. I mean, my comment is I think that this still constitutes a single subject and that the Section 4 is just talking about enforcement. And so if we're ready for a motion, I move that we deny for the motion for rehearing on Initiative 2017-18, number 126, with respect to Roman numerals 1 and 2, talking about jurisdiction and a single subject requirement.
Second.
And I actually think it's actually kind of close on the first one, because I think if Mr. Dunn could demonstrate, I can't really find this specific type of loan, but if really that is a subset of the other two, he may have a pretty viable argument on that. But given what I have in front of me, I'm going to vote that we still have jurisdiction. So all those in favor?
Aye.
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 All right, that takes us to the fiscal note.
Thank you. So if you look at the Legislative Council's fiscal impact statement and, more importantly, the abstract, I know I'm starting to sound like a broken record in front of title board, but if you look at the economic impact in particular, which is both in the impact statement and in the abstract, it says two things. It says the measure will result in smaller interest payments paid by payday borrowers and received by payday lenders. And then second, it says to the degree borrowers spend marginally more money than lenders on goods and services, the measure may increase spending in the economy. So they're saying essentially two things. That one, they're concluding that that borrowers will simply pay, the result of this measure will be payment of lower interest rates, and two, that they'll spend that discretionary money in the economy. That's flawed for two reasons. If you think about, I'm not sure it relies on anything that was submitted. The information was posted on Legislative Council's website, but there was information that was posted about employers in Colorado in this industry and the loans they provide. What the fiscal impact doesn't take into account, I think what the point of the statute is to advise voters on what is the broader economic impact of this measure. And the measure doesn't discuss potential impacts to jobs. I can tell you that a rate cap at this level will have a devastating impact on the industry in Colorado. Whether it will eliminate it completely or not, I don't know. But certainly there will be job losses as a result. And a fair, comma, and balanced fiscal impact statement would recognize that that has at least the potential for that, if not the definitive outcome of creating potentially hundreds of job losses in Colorado within the industry. So that's number one. It fails to really discuss the impact on the broader economy. Second, it actually gets the result backwards. The point of people getting loans under this statute is that they can use that money to spend in the economy. If they can't get a loan, there is no money to spend. What they will do is either bounce checks, or they will increase credit cards, or they simply won't spend. So the net result, if there is truly a decrease in the availability of this loan product, then what you'll have is less spending on the economy and less a driver of the economy. So the impact statement actually gets that backwards. I think more broadly, again, I sound like a broken record in front of the title board, but this is literally, is it two or three sentences? It is a two-sentence economic impact analysis. And I would ask, and I would contend that the title board should expect more from legislative council on something that I think has been looked at nationally and is fairly easy to figure out on the potential impacts of this type of rate cap. And I know the issue on this board's jurisdiction was raised in another measure and is currently being considered by the Supreme Court. But I think what you can do, and I'm not sure was fully evaluated in number 97 when we talked about this last time, Ms. Felgren, you weren't, I don't think you were part of that one, but I think you do have the authority to simply hold over the measure to the next hearing. I recall you doing that in the past for various reasons. And ask legislative council to redo their analysis and to provide a true economic impact study on what the impacts of this would be on the industry and jobs and spending in Colorado. And I suppose under your previous ruling, we'll see what the Supreme Court says, but I think if Leg Council then comes back to you and says we're sticking with what we wrote, then you have to make a decision. But I think it's fully within your jurisdiction to hold this over and ask them to provide a more broad look at what the impacts of the measure are. I'll pause there.
Thank you, members of the title board, Madam Chair. The fiscal impact statement, it seems like petitioner has a couple of different arguments. One, I just want to point out that the petitioner did not include documentation in his motion that supports a different estimate. And the statute at 140.107.1b plainly states that is a requirement. To the extent that the argument is that legislative council did not use the information submitted by petitioner in its fiscal estimate or abstract, that is not what the law requires. The law requires only that the legislative council take the information submitted into consideration. There are a number of reasons why that information should not have been included in the estimate or abstract. And I'll give you some, but I see that Natalie Mullis is here, and maybe she can come forward and speak to that as well. But let me give you a couple of points. The data submitted predates significant reforms in payday lending practices adopted by the General Assembly in 2010. That is the data submitted by the petitioner. The information submitted by the petitioner relies on 2007 data. And I have some documents for you here. State of Colorado Department of Law 2007 report indicates that there were 1,766,120 loans in 2007, and the amount financed was $639,506,705. And if you look to the year after the significant reforms were enacted in 2010, I shouldn't say significant, somewhat significant reforms, the number of loans went from 1.7 million to 400,000, and the amount financed went from 639 million to 167 million. So if I might, I'm going to put these into the record for you to have. So this is the 2011, this is 2007. And I also have a couple other years so you can see how it has changed. 2008, 2009, and then the most recent one, 2016, there were 414,000 loans and the amount financed was 166 million. What that indicates is the data that was submitted by the petitioner was not appropriately included in the fiscal estimate or abstract because it was so stale it wasn't relevant any longer. To the contrary, the data that was submitted by the proponents, and I will also put a copy of this into the record, it is a study by an insight study, the Center for Community Economic Development from March of 2013. And what that study indicated was that it looked at both sides of the equation. The reduction in earnings to the payday lending industry and the benefits for
there was two
the consumers of having more money in their pocket and paying less fees. Three of them were submitted to Ledge Council, and more are being submitted today. Whatever you want, the rehearing. No. And just for the record, the Insight study and the 2011 and 2016 reports were submitted to the Legislative Council, and I'm giving you a couple of additional reports so you can just see today how those numbers have gone down over time. Notwithstanding all of that, I think petitioner gets wrong that the abstract does not reference the impact on payday lenders. If you see the language under economic impact, it does so in two places. It says that the measure will result in smaller interest payments paid by payday borrowers and received by payday lenders. It also says, to the degree borrowers spend marginally more money than lenders on goods and services, the measure may increase spending in the economy. So it acknowledges that that lenders receive money and spend in the economy from payday loans. So I think in two ways the abstract addresses the concerns that the petitioner raises.
So why doesn't it need to say something about how lenders would be impacted by this measure, other than in the sentence where it indicates they would receive smaller interest payments?
Well, because I think that's all it says for the borrower too. So it just has one statement applying to each one. There's two sentences, and both of those sentences have a here's how it impacts the lender, here's how it impacts the borrower provision. And again, the data submitted by the petitioners.
Well, I do have some concern whether it adequately talks about impacts on the borrower too. Because you just kind of have that first sentence that I guess that is talking about an impact because it shows they'd be paying smaller interest payments by the borrowers and receiving smaller interest payments by the lenders. Why doesn't it need to say something about how that could affect either borrowers on the whole or lenders on the whole?
I think that the data that was submitted by the petitioners isn't accurate, and I assume that Legislative Council decided there wasn't accurate, maybe there wasn't enough data for them to put hard numbers in here. And again, maybe we should hear from Legislative Council on that point.
Yeah, let's go ahead and, I guess, does anyone have questions for Legislative Council?
I would be happy to have her talk about how they came to what they came to.
Madam Chair, before you do that, can I make
sure.
A couple comments?
Yeah.
So, I understand from Ms. Tierney that several pieces of what you're just getting, she didn't give me a copy, so I don't have it, but.
I do have extra ones that you must have gotten.
Okay, that's okay. Well, taking what she said at face value to me on the side was that most of that was the information that was submitted to Legislative Council, but at least one of them was not.
Which
that's
one
okay.
Wasn't?
Well, and I think the important point.
7, 8, 9, 11, and 16.
The ones that show up on the website are 2011 and 2016.
And the Insight report.
Yes.
Right.
The others I just show you to show how the data has changed over time.
Okay.
So I would encourage you to reject the submittal of additional information. I think what that's asking you to do is to substitute yourself for Legislative Council and make a new determination. But more importantly, I think my argument is being misunderstood. My argument is not, so this body has a statutory role that it can change the abstract if based on information submitted with the review and comment, or excuse me, with the motion for rehearing, that you feel that the numbers in the abstract are not correct. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that Legislative Council simply didn't do its job. That Legislative Council has a statutory role to provide an economic analysis. It doesn't say provide an economic analysis just based on what you receive from the proponents and maybe somebody in the public. It says go do an economic analysis. So my argument is they didn't do that. They didn't ask anything of the industry. They didn't, looks like, do any research to determine, based on what's in the fiscal impact statement, do any research on what the impact to jobs would be or how lower interest rates play out around the country. So it's not simply based on, well, is the information we submitted current or not current? It's did Legislative Council do any type of robust fiscal impact analysis?
So, Mr. Dunn, don't you feel like, I mean, you were around when we had the debate on the housing measure. I mean, didn't the Supreme Court basically give them a pass and say you can just do nothing?
I would not read it quite that broadly. I think in that particular measure, that's number four, what the Supreme Court said was we're sympathetic that figuring out the economic impact of a housing limitation that would require a future vote of the public in most of the state as to whether or not they would implement the housing growth and at what rate. They said it was just too nebulous and abstract and couldn't quite, there was no way to actually calculate a number on that. And the Supreme Court said, okay, we buy that argument. I don't think they said, you don't really have to follow the statute.
But aren't they going to say that here, that it's just nebulous about whether somebody's, maybe the lenders won't lend as much and maybe the borrowers won't borrow as much. And if they do or they don't, maybe they'll buy and maybe they won't. I mean, it seems like we're kind of back to the same place.
Well, I think you can figure that out. I mean, there's economic analysis done all the time on the impact to jobs. This is back to the oil and gas discussion about, you know, whether a setback would reduce oil and gas employment, whether that should be represented. It's the same argument. And I think there are is empirical data to show that the impact on rate reductions and the profitability and whether or not it'll affect the, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people who are employed in the industry in Colorado. But to my knowledge, in the fiscal impact statement, it doesn't make any reference to any attempt to try and figure out what that is. And I think that's all we're asking for is that they make some attempt at an economic analysis to figure out what that impact is. It doesn't have to be an exact number. I'm not saying that's the requirement. I'm saying they need to at least look at the issue and then, two, discuss whether or not it's determinable, either in a broad sense that there certainly will be some impact on jobs or concrete, and we think it will be given studies have shown that the economic viability of the businesses at this rate are not viable, and therefore would result in X number of jobs lost in Colorado. I don't think the fiscal impact statement references at all the number of people employed in the industry. I don't think there was any effort to reach out to the industry to get those numbers. So,
but aren't, I mean, isn't, I mean, how is it that you think we could send something back and direct them to do something any more than we could a proponent or an opponent? That the title board could direct them to go back and do XYZ. I mean, it seems like we have to just take what we have and deal with it. I mean, we don't have any, they don't work for the title board.
I think that's true.
The court hasn't told us you can send it back. I share your frustrations. I feel like I don't know how I'm supposed to uphold this provision when I get nothing. Maybe I'm supposed to substitute my judgment. Maybe I should start having our controller sit on title board instead of me so that, you know, someone can do a fiscal impact. I mean, I just don't quite know what to do. It seems like we're going to continue to get, you know, impacts that really have no informational.
Well, I would say a couple of things. I think more broadly, I think Legislative Council is um, is susceptible to, susceptible is not the right word. I think they are influenced by comments of the title board and what title board expects. The statute says that legislative council shall submit a fiscal impact statement and draft abstract to you by the first title board.
Right. Well, apparently they're not influenced because we were frustrated last time and we got the same thing this time. So I just...
If you're saying you requested a more robust analysis from legislative council, I don't know if that was made or not.
No, I'm just saying at the board hearing, I didn't have any communications with them outside of what happened at the board. But I mean, clearly, I think there were some frustrations at the board that we didn't have anything to work with. And then we went through that, you know, exercise of futility on fracking, and here we are back again. So
that's right. And I think, you know, if you were to hold this over and ask legislative council to do a more robust analysis, maybe that will make the point that you expect more, that you're going to hold measures over if they're not at least providing a modicum of analysis, particularly when in this one, as I argued, it's the exact opposite of what the impact would be, saying that, well, people will simply just get lower interest rates and they'll have more money to spend and everybody's happy. And that's simply not reality, and any economic analysis of any kind would bear that out.
And there's not something in the statute that authorizes us to hold it over or give legislative council any direction. You're just saying we have inherent authority to hold over a measure, and then we could just state that we were holding it over for the purpose of giving legislative council an opportunity to revise the fiscal impact statement and abstract if they chose?
Correct. The board has held over measures for other reasons.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe as to like, it was midnight. I mean, what, I can't, yeah, or someone, yeah, right. or someone continues right. it. I don't know that the board has held over except that just we weren't able to complete business.
I agree that you cannot instruct or demand legislative council redo it. Like I said earlier, they may submit the exact same thing back to you. But I think from the big picture, I think that sends the message that you would like more, that you want to demand more, and that for you to be able to do your job to draft or review an accurate abstract that provides information to voters about what the fiscal impacts of the measure are, because that's what this is all about. It's about educating the voters ahead of time, before the Blue Book process, about what the economic impacts of a measure are, and simply asking legislative council to do a better job in providing that information to you so you can do your job in drafting the abstract.
And why isn't that a better message coming from the Colorado Supreme Court or from lobbying efforts to legislative council, if you have the ability to do that? I don't know.
I hope that the Supreme Court does that, and they have that under review right now. But I also think there's a role for title board in that, because it is your job to review the abstract.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to call her up here and ask her if she didn't get that we were frustrated, but I bet she'll tell us that she got it. I mean, I guess I just don't think we can send it back and tell them what to do. But I mean, I'm happy to hear your arguments about, you know, thing. I mean, I'm sympathetic to it about maybe things you would want to see struck or added or that kind of thing. But I'm just not sure I can. Maybe the board disagrees with me, but I don't.
I think that is. I'm not telling you all how to do your job as title board members, but I think that's a slippery slope for the title board if every fiscal impact review turns into an evidentiary hearing. We got into that in number 97, where we had proponents testifying as sort of expert witnesses on the health impacts of oil and gas development.
It was awful.
It spun out of control a little bit. And I think that if your only recourse is to say to opponents of a measure or even proponents, hey, if you want to provide us some evidence here so that we amend the abstract, then we're certainly welcome that. Because I think what you're then going to get into is most title board hearings turning into an evidentiary hearing with experts and documents being passed out. And you thought drafting titles was bad. Abstracts will become a whole lot worse.
Well, my controller will be here. So.
Quick comment on just kind of a general I mean, my understanding of the term an abstract, you know, if you have an abstract of a scientific article or something.
Scientifical?
Yes.
Scientific article. I want to check with your lawyer on that term.
A scientific article, the abstract is going to be a summary of the contents, or, you know, maybe put in hopefully a little easier to understand language. And I would think, and tell me if you disagree with this, that maybe, although it is not expressed in the statute, that we should consider the abstract along those same lines, and meaning that if we were to amend the abstract, I would think that our amendment should generally relate to something in the body of the fiscal impact statement as opposed to bringing in something else that is not discussed in the statement itself. Do you have a comment on that?
I think in a perfect world, that's exactly right. The statute does allow for at least the opponents to submit additional data in challenging. It actually, I believe the language is in challenging the estimate. So in other words, if I think the number that, I mean, the statute clearly contemplates a number. And if the opponents believe that the number is inaccurate, they can submit additional information as to why that number is incorrect. But to your point also, if you look at the fiscal impact statement here, there's sort of a summary of the measure and there's some background. But if you look at the actual section that is the economic impact of the estimate itself, not the abstract, but the estimate, it's the exact same language. It's just two sentences. So it's not really a summary of anything. It's just verbatim the same two sentences.
Okay. Let's hear from Ledge Service. Hi. Go ahead and just introduce yourself and tell us about how you reached your conclusion on the abstract.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the HUD Board. For the record, I'm Natalie Millis, Fiscal Director with Legislative Council staff. We did not do a full-blown economic analysis for this. We did consider and study the materials that were given to us from both the proponents of the measure and other interested persons, and the measures, or the materials that were given to us are posted on our website. And we took all of that into consideration. The result of our economic impact statement is what we believe is the briefest summary, given that it's an abstract, of the bottom line impact on the economy, where you consider that there will be costs to the payday lending industry and there will be benefits to consumers. We do believe that we met the statutory requirements, and our interpretation of the statute appears to be, based on what I've observed from Mr. Dunn's explanations and presentations, very different from his interpretation. And I have the statute in front of me, and I'd just like to, with your patience, read it. The initial fiscal impact statement, which is not the abstract, must be substantially similar in form and content to the fiscal notes provided by the Legislative Council of the General Assembly for legislative measures pursuant to Section 22322 CRS, indicate whether there is a fiscal impact for the initiated measure, and include an abstract, as described in subsection 3 of this section. Subsection 3 says the abstract must include an estimate, which to me indicates a number, if we can get it, of the effect the measure will have on state and local government revenues, expenditures, taxes, and fiscal liabilities if the measure is enacted, a statement of the measure's economic benefits for all Coloradans, not an estimate, a statement, an estimate of the amount of any state and local government recurring expenditures or fiscal liabilities if the measure is enacted, that is, of course, if we can get the estimate, and it, for any initiated measure that modifies the state tax laws, an estimate if feasible, of the impact to the average taxpayer if the measure is enacted, and the following statement, which appears at the top of each of the abstracts. To me, that tells me that we have complied with the law, that we have provided a statement of the economic benefits for all Coloradans to the best of our ability and based on the economic knowledge that we have in our consideration of the materials that were presented to us and consideration of other resources that we have in our body of knowledge. I understand your frustration that you would like to see some numbers. And believe me, it is always our intention to provide numbers if we can. The honest truth is that providing numbers for these kinds of analyses for the economic impacts generally requires a dynamic analysis, some kind of model like IMPLAN or REMI, where you make an assumption for how the economic inputs into those models will change as a result of a policy, and then see what the model says about that. We have a lot of concerns about these dynamic models. The biggest concern is that initial estimate, that initial assumption that is the input into the model. And we talked about that at a prior title board hearing on Initiative 97. The other concern we have about those models is that we think that although they are excellent academic tools for answering many, many different questions, for the purposes of a fiscal note where we are able to say this is our best analysis for what will actually happen, we don't think that the standard is met because there are so many assumptions that must go into those models. And we don't have the ability to make sure, you know, to vet every single one of those assumptions. It requires a lot of resources and a lot more time than we have to put these analyses together. So when this bill was passed, we never interpreted that an estimate, which would require a dynamic analysis, would be required by the statute. And if the statute did require an estimate of an economic analysis, we would have asked for resources that we don't have right now to do that.
But what about the, I mean, it says you must have these things. And, I mean, we don't have them. I mean, it says it must include an estimate. And then when you read that part of it, you say, you know, if you can get one. Well, the statute doesn't say if you can get one. It says it must include.
For the impact on the state and local governments?
And
if the estimate is indeterminate, then that's what the estimate is.
So how do you interpret the phrase, a statement of the measure's economic benefits for all Coloradans? What does that require the Legislative Council to do?
What it requires is for us to do what we have been doing, to take into consideration our body of knowledge on the subject and take into consideration everything that is provided to us and summarize what we think the economic impact is on the economy.
Well, and it appears to me that what we have does have, where it specifically asks for an estimate, it's with regard to the governmental side. And it has that. It says it's not expected to affect it, the governmental side. As for the broader effect on the economy, as you say, that's a statement. And you know, the statute isn't specific as to the level of analysis that the fiscal analysts are to bring to it. The only thing the statute's specific to is taking into consideration information submitted by proponents or other interested persons. And first, I mean, I am no fiscal analyst or controller or accountant or even ever took accounting. So in looking at these, I mean, I don't see how this is information that would specifically tell somebody what is the effect of changing this percentage rate. I mean, this is very generalized information, and it doesn't appear that anything was submitted as to what is the effect of limiting the annual percentage rate to 36%. And I don't know where that would come from. And because I don't have that level, I do not feel at all qualified to substitute my judgment for that of the fiscal analysts in saying that this could have been done better, should have been done better. I don't see any authority in the statute for us to specifically ask the fiscal analysts to reconsider. And I actually don't see any authority for the fiscal analyst to submit an amended abstract. It says that they submit the initial abstract and the initial fiscal analysis, and then if it's placed on the ballot, then they prepare new estimates. there's not a procedure for amendments or changes to the initial one. The only procedure for changes is the title board being able to change the abstract based on information submitted to the title board. And as I said, I don't think any of the information that I've received is convincing or compelling enough to give me the basis for second guessing what the fiscal analyst did.
I think when we talked to you about 97, you had indicated that there had been some prior proposed legislation that was similar, and that the initial fiscal impact statement you prepared with respect to Initiative 97 was similar to the fiscal notes for those. Do you have anything like that here? Has this ever been, you know, a reduction in payday lending interest rates ever been proposed as legislation? And did you compare those fiscal notes with the fiscal impact statement produced here?
There have been legislation, in particular in 2010, there was a lot of legislation. And honestly, I did not go back and look at those fiscal notes. I'm sure that the analyst who wrote the fiscal impact statement did, however, and I would expect that they would be very similar in form and content to what was produced at the time.
And then a second question I have is, did legislative council, in producing this initial fiscal impact statement, consider any studies or analyses specifically addressing the question of limiting, reducing or limiting interest rate to something anywhere near, it wouldn't have to be exactly 36%, but some sort of limitation as is proposed in the initiative?
Well, the report that was given to us by the proponents was a report, was an analysis, and you have it in front of you. I don't have it in front of me, but it is a dynamic analysis that used an IMPLAM model. Oh, thank you.
Are you referring to the Insight?
Yes, the
okay.
Insight report. And this is we would not have used the numbers in this report in our abstract, and the reason that we wouldn't have done that is because it's from a biased source. As nonpartisan staff, if we were going to put numbers together, we would not use numbers from a biased source. We would do our own analysis and run our own model. And again, that's because we need to make sure that all of the assumptions and all of the, not only that initial assumption, but every assumption that's inherent in the model, are nonpartisan and unbiased.
So then what did you rely on to come up with to the degree borrowers spend marginally more money on goods and services, the measure will result in additional spending in the economy?
Well, probably a combination of two things. First, economic theory. Basic economic theory talks about the marginal propensity to spend for people at different places in the income distribution. And we know that the marginal propensity to spend, or at least that part of every additional dollar of income that a person or a household gets, if they are poor, they're going to spend a lot more of that than a wealthier household or individual or business.
And did you consider what Mr. Dunn said, that perhaps these loans won't exist or people won't be able to borrow money to then buy the goods? I mean, the kinds of arguments that he presented in coming up with this kind of a statement, or did you assume everything would remain as is? There would still be the same number of lenders, same number of loans, and just people would be paying less for them.
Well, clearly incentives matter, and if a price for a product falls, then the amount of that product that is offered is going to fall as well. And so that is definitely part of the qualitative analysis that we went through. I wouldn't expect that it would completely dry up. However, his concern about the principal of the loans not being available for spending, that is something we thought about as well. And because that principal, it's a payday loan, and the principal has to be repaid, that just moves money around over time. And even if some of these are defaulted on, it's money out of the pocket of the lender, not out of the consumer. So, you know, that was less of an impact on the margin than considering the fact that the price has changed. So now consumers have to pay less for these loans, and lenders get less. Their price is lower. So just it moves income around in the economy. It moves income from lenders to consumers, to low-income consumers.
Any other questions? No. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Right, Mr. Dunn, you want to say anything in response to that, and then we'll hear from Ms. Tierney, and then we can...
Yeah, and I don't want to belabor it, but I would say two things. One, what I just heard at the end, and I'm sympathetic to the position there, and I've said this last time, that they have a short time window. They've been asked by the legislature to do this analysis. But the law is the law, and the law says that they need to do a fiscal impact analysis and provide that to voters so they can be educated when they're deciding whether to sign a petition. Essentially, what I heard her say at the end was, we pretty much made it up. We didn't do any extra research. We sort of just used our background and knowledge, and we kind of made it up. They didn't consider the stuff that we submitted because it was biased. I would hope she would say the same about the proponent's information. So she disregarded everything that was submitted. They didn't do any research, and they sort of just used abstract economic theory to come up with something. I think that's the best description of it. Second, she did say one thing, and I should have jotted it down because I would rather quote her verbatim, but I believe she said, we concluded that it would have an impact on the industry. Okay. I don't know how they came to that conclusion, but I agree with her on that statement. If that's what she said, that certainly is not represented in the fiscal impact statement or the abstract. So that statement alone shows that the abstract is not accurate. She said it will impact the industry.
Do you have a view as to what is required by the phrase in Part B in the statute, a statement of the measure's economic benefits for all Coloradans?
So we went through this a little bit on 97, I think. That measure was added, I believe, on the floor in the House of Representatives as an amendment. And the discussion at the time was really about, well, okay, we have language in the statute about an estimate of the impacts to state and local government revenue. I'm not really sure what the difference is between the first one and the third one, but they generally relate to estimates of impacts on state and local government. There was a discussion on the floor, well, wait a minute, shouldn't we really be talking also about how it affects Coloradans generally in the economy and citizens and voters and employees of industry that are affected by a particular piece of or particular initiative? And that amendment was offered on the floor. I would submit that it's not particularly artfully drafted. I think it was meant to be both benefits and negative impacts, but it was done on the fly on the House floor, I believe, and was amended into the statute for that reason.
Thank you, members of the title board. Madam Chair, Martha Tierney. I want to respond to a couple things. First of all, with all due respect to Mr. Dunn, I don't think he can be testifying about the intent of the legislature when it enacted that amendment and what they intended or didn't intend. We've got the plain language in front of us, and it says a statement. The legislative council testified here that what they've provided you is a statement, and that statement does take into account the impact on the lender, where it says that smaller interest payments paid by borrowers and received by lenders.
Well, it's true that it says a statement, but the whole thing is a statement, right? An initial fiscal impact statement. So I'm not sure how much we can read into the use of that word as needing something less analytical or less evaluative.
Well, but a plain reading analysis would suggest that it does mean something different, because estimate is used in the other two provisions. And the estimate, there is, as Ms. Mullis testified, there is no real impact on state and local revenue. The bill that keeps being referenced from 2010, it was House Bill 101351. On that bill, there was no fiscal impact. The fiscal impact statement said, the fiscal note said no fiscal impact. So it's consistent with what they did in that legislation in 2010, what was done here. I want to make two other comments. One, I think there is a lot of language in Smith versus Hayes, which is that initiative number 4 from last year, the Housing Authority, where the court really does talk about how this body can accept evidence and hear testimony and make a decision. So the suggestion that the only entity that gets to provide you information is the objector in their motion for rehearing, we reject. And that the things that we have submitted here today and will continue to submit in the latter half of this hearing should be properly a part of the record that you can consider. I think that there's no ambiguity in the court's statement in that case about that.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I think that's enough.
Oh, okay. All right. Any discussion by the board?
So I think the primary issue, as I understand it, that we need to decide is whether to do some sort of a hold or try to provide some direction to legislative council on this, as opposed to actually amending the abstract, and I don't see authority for us to do that. Certainly I think we could put something on hold if we wanted to, but I don't know that would have much effect. And then as Julie pointed out, I don't know that the statute provides a way for legislative council, or it certainly doesn't expressly provide an opportunity for them to amend the abstract. So I think I would be inclined to deny the motion for rehearing to the extent that it's asking us to hold this over or try to get legislative council to do something in addition. I do want to express concerns about the economic impact. You know, it certainly does just say a statement. It doesn't expressly require an estimate there, but I think the intent is to try to provide some indication to voters and guidance and information to voters in the abstract that would enable them to understand how this could affect the economy. And I'm not sure that this does. I'm concerned both, as Mr. Dunn has pointed out, about it not talking about how it would affect lenders. I think it also doesn't indicate how it would affect borrowers as far as availability of these kinds of loans. You know, certainly, obviously, there's a reason that they get payday loans, that people get payday loans, and to the extent that this would dry up availability of those, that could have a negative effect on them as well. So, anyway, I don't think that's, I guess that's just an expression of concern I have about the economic impact statements and initiatives and abstracts that we're getting, but I don't know that it changes my view as to what we should do today as a board.
Yeah, I don't, I agree. I don't think we can send it back. I think we could change it if we wanted to based on the guidance we got in that case. And I know it's something we probably don't want to do, but on the other hand, it seems like producing this, the impact is also not something Legislative Services wants to do. And I'm not sure whether we want to or not is really relevant. I do think that when it says a statement of the measure's economic benefits for all Coloradans, I guess I tend to agree with Mr. Roper that has to mean something other than just, you know, 20 words that don't really offer any
numbers or anything really definitive. I mean, I read that to have meant a statement, which is part of the fiscal impact statement, and the fiscal impact statement has to do with the fiscal impact. And so I guess I believe that to mean a little bit more than what we've been getting, but I don't have any authority to tell anybody that. I think that's, again, something the Supreme Court has to do if that's what they want to do. So at this point, I'm inclined to deny the motion for rehearing, and based on jurisdiction and based on the abstract, and move on to title.
And I would just add that I agree that if we had information that had been provided by the proponents, that would give us a basis for having a reasoned, supportable, credible change to the abstract. I would be willing to do it, but I don't have that information. And so without having that information, I don't know how I would change the abstract. And I think that's our only option, change it or don't change it.
Can I comment on that point?
Sure.
So based on what Ms. Mullen said, that it will have an impact on the industry, I would request and ask you to consider amending the abstract to say that the measure will, or to be fair, may, have an impact on the number of jobs in the industry, or something more artfully said than that. But I think based on what she said, you can add to the abstract that it at least could have a negative impact on the employment base in the industry.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
Martha Tierney on behalf of the proponents. I don't think that what Natalie Mullis said was that it had an impact on jobs. She said that it had an impact on the industry. And what you've got before you says that. So you don't have anything before you that is tells you that it has a negative impact on jobs in any real way, and what 36% would have as a negative impact on jobs, or if it would have a negative impact on jobs.
I'm inclined to agree, and I think just as to whether it's really jobs or it's the industry in some other way, or it's the availability of loans. Again, I don't have the information to feel comfortable making that statement, and to just make the general statement, it may have a negative impact on the industry. I'm not sure that that's helpful to voters, because I don't know what that means.
Well, I mean, this other part's not really helpful either. But.
So two unhelpfuls.
So I guess I feel like if we had a study that talked about reducing interest rates and the effect that would have, and if it concluded, made some substantive conclusions about how that affects the industry, I'd be willing to add maybe a comma after the first sentence and say which could, fill in something there. But as I sit here right now, I'm not sure that, I just don't feel like I have anything like that would provide me sufficient confidence to make that change.
Yeah. So, I guess notice to everyone to do their own economic impact. It's going to make for some long title hearings in April. All right. So you want to make a motion?
Yeah. So I'll move that we, for initiative 2017-18, number 126, that we deny the motion for rehearing with respect to the statements on the fiscal impact statement and the abstract.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That takes us to the title, I think. Go ahead.
I thought this would be a short hearing.
I didn't.
So on title, we have two arguments. I think it'll be a little more straightforward. One is that we think the title is misleading because it doesn't reference the changes to the unfair practices portion of the measure in any way. It simply references the limitations on the lenders and changing the interest rate. So that's number one. But number two, we contend that the use of the phrase payday lenders and payday loans are catchphrases that are clearly pejorative terms. The statute, while it does include that language, was only, ironically, was added in 2010. Prior to that, didn't use that language at all. The statute is captioned as the Deferred Deposit Loan Act, and throughout the Act refers to it as that. So we would contend that those are catchphrases that do nothing more than elicit voter support for the measure without actually understanding how the statute works or what the measure does.
So what would you, instead of the word, I had this concern last time, I think, instead of the word payday loans, what would your, I don't want to use that other, whatever you just said.
Well, I was going to say, I think there are two options. One is deferred deposit loans. Problem is, I'm not sure they are that.
Yeah.
And the other is
just loans, personal.
Short-term installment loans.
I'm sorry, short-term what?
Installment loans.
Installment.
Short-term installment loans.
How about as to your first concern, what concept do you think needs to be included from the change to the, you know, the Section 4 of the initiative?
I think that's a good question. I think given our prior discussion and the uncertainty about what types of transactions it's actually changing or referring to, I think probably the easiest way to do it would be to simply say and amending the types of conduct and transactions deemed unfair practices under the Act. Okay. Something of that nature.
Ms. Tierney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. So I have some more documents for you on this topic. And I do have some for Mr. Dunn, and I apologize, I had the other documents for you too. They went up into the black hole. Okay, I'm gonna talk about the catchphrase piece first, and I'd like to give you three different documents. One is a administrator of the Colorado Consumer Credit Union staff report, Colorado, on payday lending from July 2000 through December 2015. Two is a packet of screenshots and pictures depicting payday lenders throughout the state of Colorado. And the fourth is a screenshot from the Attorney General's Office, Colorado Uniform Consumer Credit Code. What these show you is that payday loans are what these loans are called. And the industry themselves call themselves that. They don't call themselves deferred deposit loans. The document from the Attorney General's office that you have before you indicates that payday loans, which is what they call them as well, are different from small installment loans. So you can't call them small installment loans. The statute itself, as Mr. Dunn acknowledges, references the term payday loan.
Why can't you call them short-term installment loans?
Because there is another animal that is a short-term installment loan. If you look at this document, the Colorado Uniform Consumer Credit Code General Information screenshot from the Colorado Attorney General's Office website, small installment lender. So if you call them small installment loans, you're going to be confusing them with which is a different statutory provision.
So we could call them deferred deposit loans?
You could, but nobody will know what you're talking about. So I want to remind...
How about short-term installment loans?
Is that different?
Because this says small installment lenders.
Well, I would submit to you that no one's going to know what that is. And I'll remind you of the measures from 2015, 2016 regarding malt and vinous liquor, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court, that full-strength beer and wine was a catchphrase. And there, the court affirmed the title board's use of the term full-strength wine and liquor because nobody knows what malt and vinous liquor is.
But do you think people really know what a... I mean, payday loans aren't really payday loans, are they? I mean, they're not necessarily loans that you just get until payday, right?
Well, they often are.
Well, they can be, but you can also... Sounds like other kinds of transactions fall into...
The point, I think, here, Madam Chair, is that this is what they are called. The industry themselves call them that. If you use a different term, the voters are not going to know what that is. The packet of photos and screenshots is from all over the state. You won't see one that calls it a deferred deposit loan or a short-term installment loan. The signs on the front of the storefronts are payday loans. I don't, the law on catchphrases, it makes clear that they are words that work in favor of a proposal without contributing to voter understanding. Here, if you take out that term, you won't have voter understanding of what this measure is. The Supreme Court has also held that catchphrases which are not part of the text of a proposed measure should be excised from a ballot title. Here, and in the court in Henry versus Baker, 354 P. Second, 490, 1960, said that where the term is part of the measure, that you don't have the same concerns about catchphrases. Here, the government uses that term in its study, which I just handed out to you. The statute uses that term right now in Title 5, Article 3.1. Since 2010, that term is the term that is used everywhere. So I don't think it falls into a catchphrase. Mr. Dunn indicates that that's a pejorative term, but the industry itself uses that term to describe themselves. It's not as though we're not using the term loan shark or something like that. I mean, payday loan is what these loans are now known as. And I think the 2015-2016 initiative 60 and 61 regarding the malt and vinous liquors situation is very analogous here, where you can't take out or include language that does not tell the voter what they're voting on.
Yeah, but you could just tell the voter this is, I mean, you could describe the type of loan. I mean, the problem with beer and wine was that nobody would know what malt liquor was. I mean, people would know what a short-term loan is. Nobody would know what a vinous spirit
is. But this isn't a short-term loan. This is different. This is a payday loan. This is a loan where you have to pledge something to the lender, whether it's a check that is postdated, whether it is a automatic bank withdrawal authorization that goes on the date of pay. When you get paid, they take it out. This is not... If you use the term short-term installment loan, you will not be telling the voters what these are.
And you feel like that's true with deferred deposit loan as well?
I think nobody knows what deferred deposit loan is.
Well, that's a term used primarily in the statute.
They're both used in the statute.
In the definition, it does add payday loan. It says deferred deposit loan or payday loan to define it, but then throughout the rest of the article. It just uses deferred deposit loan.
With all due respect, Mr. Roper, it does not. It uses payday loan in several other places in the measure.
Okay.
From that 2010 statutory change, and I'm trying to find the exact references.
In section 5, 3.1, 105. I was going to look at 104, the notice to consumers that they have to post.
And in 105?
Says deferred deposit loan.
Oh,
so,
well,
so 105 does use the term payday loan.
Yes.
You're right.
105 uses the term payday loan.
So it's in the definition, and then it's used in 105, and then not throughout the rest of the 23 sections of the article. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, settles it one way or the other, but the statute primarily refers to them as deferred deposit loans.
The statute was, so what I will submit to you is that as of 2010, when the statute added that language, that term became the primary, predominantly used term. You'll see it in the reports that I handed out earlier.
That term, payday,
payday loan.
Loan.
Okay. That the state uses that term now when referencing these loans. You'll see it on this document.
Which lists both, right? Deferred deposit / payday lenders.
Yes.
Do you think it makes a difference that the notice to consumers that they have to place in a prominent place on each loan agreement uses the term deferred deposit loan?
Do I think it makes a difference for this title?
In terms of how much, whether people know what a deferred deposit loan is.
Well, I think in the statute, the definitions defines them interchangeably.
I understand, but when I get my loan documents clearly say a deferred deposit loan is not intended to meet. A deferred deposit loan should be used, renewing the deferred deposit loan. So my documents, when I get one of these, apparently say deferred deposit loan.
Well,
do I read them? I don't know, but that's the documents.
Do you think the average voter in Colorado would know what that is?
It's on their document.
But do you think the average voter in Colorado got a deferred deposit loan?
I don't know.
I would submit that most voters won't know what that is.
What's your thought about adding something to the title describing the Section 4 piece about the unfair practices?
So I believe that the unfair practices section is an enforcement and implementation portion of the measure, which is not required to be in the title. Title does not have to have every single piece of the measure, and it makes clear that the measure is about limitations on payday lenders, and the enforcement section is about how you can't engage in activity to evade the limitations on payday lenders. So I think it's not necessary.
Would you be opposed to adding language, or you just don't think it's needed?
We would oppose adding language.
Okay. Great. Discussion? I'm inclined to go with deferred deposit. I think I was last time, but in terms of the other issue with describing the other kinds of practices, I think they're all part of, you know, the loan. I'm not sure it's really central to the measure, but I'm willing to put something in about that too if we really want to go that way.
As the newbie, can I ask, do we ever, or does it just call it out as a catchphrase if you said limitations on deferred deposit lenders and in connection therewith reducing the charges on deferred deposit loans, parentheses, commonly known as a payday loan.
Ms. Tierney?
I think you're going to confuse all the voters on that. And if you insist on putting that in, it's got to be in the first phrase. Because people don't read that far. And they're going to think it's some Wall Street thing.
I mean, if the catchphrase is a catchphrase, and I don't think we should put it in the title. I mean, it's one or the other. Neither okay. goes in the single subject or it doesn't. Anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to just reiterate that it's already in the statute. It's what the government calls these things. I don't see how that can be seen as a catchphrase.
Given that the court considers it phrases that, quote, work in favor of proposal without contributing to voter understanding, leads me to lean toward go ahead and using payday, just because I do agree that I don't think people will understand what it's talking about if you don't.
Yeah, my problem is I'm not sure people know what a payday loan is either. I don't know that they really understand the types of transactions that can go on with payday loans or whether they think it is simply someone who has a job and then they pledge their check forward. I mean, that's the problem with the phrase to me is, I mean, people will know what storefronts we're describing. That I get, but I'm not sure they'll know what that actually is.
How about deferred deposit or payday lenders?
Yeah, I mean, it's just if payday is a catchphrase, then it's a catchphrase. And I don't think we should use it in the title. If we want to use it in the title because we think it's not a catchphrase, then we should just put it in the single subject and forget deferred deposit.
So where I am, I can see the argument. I'm fine keeping payday in the title. I do not think it's a, or I'm not so convinced that it's a catchphrase that I think we have to make a change to what we did last time.
Yeah, I mean, my problem with it is when we say, well, this is how it's advertised on the, you know, Attorney General's website. Well, yeah, under file a complaint, consumer alert. I mean, it's kind of advertised like this is a bad thing in some ways. I mean, it's licensed supervised lenders and their disciplinary history. I mean, that's not a positive portrayal of a payday lender. And I'm not making a qualitative, you know, are they good or are they bad? I'm just saying that the way that it's referenced there is almost like a consumer alert. And the fact that it's on the storefronts, I don't really think helps people understand what they are. And if the industry is here saying we think you're using it as a catchphrase, I mean, it's a little different than what we had in alcohol, where the industry was saying that's what people think of it as. And here we're having the proponent. I don't know. It's just a little different in my mind. Go ahead, Ms. Tierney.
I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, Martha Tierney. I just wanted to point out that I think that the page you're referencing is a general information page about all sorts of consumer credit. And yes, it does have a file a complaint button, but the page is not about policing the industry. It's providing information about these different lenders.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I don't think the complaint button or the UCC reference in the upper right is intended to go specifically to that middle information. I think it's that information at the top and on the side kind of stay there regardless of which pages you go to.
And the idea that it's a pejorative term, the fact that the industry itself uses it all the time. The industry's adopted it, so they don't apparently feel like it's pejorative. I think they know that there's a lot of people that understand, that know the type of loans as under that name.
Well, they may be marketing to a certain, I mean, there's a lot of examples of that where a certain profession has to call itself that profession to capture the market, but maybe the general population doesn't approve of the profession. Anyway, it sounds like.
Do you think it's a catchphrase? Is that where you are? Or?
Yeah, I'm at catchphrase, but it sounds like you two aren't. So, I mean.
Yeah, I don't think I am. Although it's, I can see the argument, but I think it's used in the statute, used in the industry. And I don't think that it is pejorative and not providing information or you know, works in favor of a proposal without contributing to voter understanding. So I do not think it's a catchphrase.
Okay, do you want to add the other or do you not? Or do you want to just leave it the way it is?
I don't feel a need to add in an additional phrase about that section 4.
Nor do I.
Okay. Then just make a motion to deny the reading.
I'll make a motion that for initiative 2017-18 number 126 that we deny the motion for rehearing in its entirety.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And all oppose? That passes 2-1, and that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 125, labeling requirements for genetically modified food. Morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. If you want to just
doing.
Good. If you want to just start out and just tell us your name, and then if you could have your co-proponent introduce himself so that we can make sure you're both here for the record.
My name is Matthew Calloway. I'm a proponent of the measure number 125.
Okay.
At the microphone, please, sir. We're on the record, so we need to capture your voice.
My name is Jonathan Letty. I'm a proponent of the measure 125.
All right. Thank you. And if you want to start out today, if you could just tell us what you believe the single subject of your measure is.
The single subject of the measure is labeling of GMO foods.
Okay. And did you also get a chance to look at the staff draft of the language proposed?
I did.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for the proponent on single subject?
Not on single subject.
The one question I have, and I just want to raise this just to make sure you're aware of Title 7 of the United States Code, Section 1639I, is a federal preemption provision that limits what states and political subdivisions of a state can do with respect to labeling on GMO foods. Now, I don't think that's going to change single subject because we don't that's not something that we consider, but I just want to make sure that the proponents are aware of that statutory provision.
We are. It came up in the review and comment hearing, and we fell back on the 10th Amendment because I know that is an argument, but the truth is I don't think that federal law protects our citizens, you know, to the extent that we need them to be protected, and so pretty much.
Yeah, and
thank God for the 10th Amendment in this case, because that's kind of trampling on our rights to know what's in what we feed our children.
Thank you, and I don't think it changes what we do. I just want to make sure proponents were aware of that statute.
All right, any questions on single subject?
No.
Then you want to make a motion? Or is there anyone signed up on this? I don't think so. No. All right.
I move that as to proposed initiative 2017-18 number 125, we find that it has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. That takes us to the staff draft. You have any comments on the language?
None except for the question mark at the end of it. But I guess I figured it out. Maybe it wasn't clear.
And that may be, if I could just comment briefly, that there's two paragraphs in the staff draft. The first one describes it, and the second one poses the question that would go to the voters, should we make this change? Question mark.
Oh, I see.
I don't know if that clarifies.
It does a little bit. Okay. And then for me, that question mark looked like it only pertained to the little subsection that takes away the public right of action. You know, and so, oh, yeah. But that's an entire section. All right. A little misleading there.
I actually have a question on, in going through the original and the changes, et cetera, when you go to your amendments to section 25.5.4.11, parentheses 1, in the original and the existing law reads, a food shall be deemed to be misbranded, colon. And in your new version, and then all of the paragraphs that come after that start with if. And in your new version, it wasn't highlighted as a change, but it's in there that it's a food shall be deemed to be misbranded if, colon. So if nothing else, I think we should make a technical change to put the if in small caps to show that it's new. And was that your intent to have the if at the beginning? Because that kind of throws up all of the other paragraphs that come after that, because they all start with the word if.
So because I removed on section Q there the if it.
Yeah.
And then
yeah, I noticed the same thing, and I don't know if you're trying to add the word if to that beginning phrase, or if that just accidentally crept in there and is not supposed to be, you know.
In the one in the definitions of misbranding part you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, before you get to the lettered subsection.
It's possible that did get slipped in there. Let me, maybe we figured it worked better, but if it's not going to work, then I totally secede to your guys' recommendation on that.
Yeah.
So I guess my thought would be if it's just a, you know, a Scrivener's error, a typo, so to speak, that maybe the word if should not be, you know, should be stricken from that.
Really, maybe. Because, I mean, it still makes sense. A food shall be deemed to be misbranded. Any food, we don't really need if here, or we don't need an if there, honestly. Just slash all the ifs.
Well, if you look at the other, you know, the existing, I don't know if you have the existing subsections. pulled up there.
That I don't have
okay.
pulled up right here.
As Julie indicated, most of them begin with the word if.
I see.
So if you keep the if here, it says the food shall be deemed to be misbranded if.
Right. It's a double if.
Yeah.
So let's, I mean, is this something that I have to go back and do? Or can we just scratch the if?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not substantive.
Yeah, I think we can make it technical correction.
Yeah. If you agree it's a technical correction, we'll just make it. Okay.
100%.
Do you want to make a motion?
Yeah. So I'll move that we make a technical correction within Section 3 of the proposed initiative to strike the word if from the first line of the changes to statute number 5411.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And then just another little technical correction. I think in Section 1 of your measure, 25.5401.5, the language after parentheses 1 there should also be in small caps. So if we could just make a technical correction on that as well.
Okay. You want to add that to your motion?
I missed that. Could you say that one more time?
Where it reads at the very beginning, the electorate of Colorado hereby finds, determines, and declares that. That should be in small caps. It's new language.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'll move that as to proposed initiative 2017-18 number 125. We also make a technical correction in section 1, where the language following the declaration in the new section 25.5401.5, it reads, the electorate of Colorado hereby finds, determines, and declares that. Should be in small caps because it is added language.
I agree.
Okay.
So I'll make that motion.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. So back to the language of the proposed staff draft. Do you have other comments on?
No.
So I actually have another comment, and back to that section 25.5411. I had a hard time following this sentence. A food shall be deemed to be misbranded beginning July 1st, 2020. Any food that has been genetically modified or has been produced with genetic engineering, unless the words and then talks about word. It just as a grammatical matter, I think I understand what you want to happen, but I just had a hard time getting the syntax to work in my head. It's deemed to be misbranded, any food unless, and then it changes down at the end to must be and must be. And I don't think there's anything we can do here about that. I guess I just asked the proponents to, you know, go back and reread the sentence and just try to make sure it's fitting in with what's there. But maybe if you could just really briefly explain your understanding of what that subsection is intended to do.
Sure.
Yeah, because I think that's the meat of.
It is. That is the meat of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much worded to fit all this stuff in there and still get the point across in an efficient manner without writing paragraphs
okay.
about it. So it's really meant to be read in one complete sentence that a food is deemed to be misbranded beginning July 1st, 2020, anything that has been genetically modified or has been produced with genetic engineering, unless the words are on there, then it's going to be misbranded. Does that follow? Unless those words are on the package, if it's been genetically modified, then the food is deemed to be misbranded and subject to any penalties.
And I know we struck your if from the top. It just seems like there, you may need an if somewhere in here. And again, that up to you as to what language you proposed, but I just encourage you to take a look at that and just make sure it's saying what you want it to say. But your intent is to have it say that if food is misbranded unless it contains those words, and the distributor and the retailer have to keep those words on the packaging. Is that?
I think any manufacturer is going to have a hard time arguing the fact that they didn't understand the intention of that, and so they didn't label their product.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just trying to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
But that's
have the label on there.
That's the intent.
Otherwise, the food is misbranded.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
I think I'm done sidetracking.
Okay. So. No, that's fine. Does anyone on the board have comments about the language?
I was thinking that it had a good deal of detail, which sometimes we don't go with, but then I looked back at the substantially similar provision, and it's the same as it was for the substantially similar provision that ran, what,
a couple years ago?
Yeah. So I guess I'm okay with it the way it is.
Yeah, I think there's probably some language that could be removed if we wanted to. It does kind of go into detail about what foods are exempted and lists some that are, but doesn't include others that are. And then also, I don't know that we need the phrase about requiring regulation by CDPHE. I'd be inclined to take out some of that, but also don't feel particularly strongly about it. I didn't compare it to an earlier provision, so if it's the same or similar to what we did before, I'd be okay leaving it too.
It's pretty similar to what we set. It might have been in 14, maybe. I don't know. What year was tail docking, Stephen? 14. And I know there was quite a bit of back and forth, and so I'm inclined to leave it just because I don't remember who the opponents were, but if the opponents come back, this is essentially language that the court, I think, approved once it went up. But
and I'm fine with that.
And it's a, you know, different board, so if you all want to strike stuff, you can have that whole conversation about whether a cow can be genetically modified. I'm pretty sure it's an organic being, but we had that conversation.
Sorry, I missed that.
You remember that? Yeah. Those were the days. So anyway, whatever you all want to do, but I'm inclined to leave it.
To your point that it lists some of them, but not all of them in terms of the exemptions, the earlier one did say including but not limited to those that were produced. And I know that but not limited to is implied by the word including, but if you want to be clear that there really are more, we could add that.
I'm okay leaving it as it is, okay, if nobody feels the need to make a change.
Okay. Then I'm going to read it just for the record. It's a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning labeling of genetically modified food and in connection therewith requiring food that has been genetically modified or produced with genetic engineering to be labeled, quote, contains genetically modified ingredients, unquote, starting on July 1st, 2020, exempting some foods from the labeling requirement, including those that were produced or derived with genetic engineering, certain food that is not packaged for retail sale, food from an animal that has not itself been genetically engineered, and medically prescribed food, requiring the Colorado Department of Health and Environment to regulate the labeling of genetically modified food and specifying that no private right of action is created for failure to conform to the labeling requirements.
I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2017-18, number 125, as it appears on the board and was read into the record.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. I'm sure Dan Domenico is sad he missed the second round.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, guys. So that's it, huh?
Yep, that's it. Well, unless somebody files a rehearing, and then that's not it. Then you'll be back.
Uh-oh.
Thanks. All right. Well, thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Take care. We'll see you.
All right. The next measure is 2017.
Can we take a short break? And because Jason Gellender is.
Oh, he's here.
Oh, he is here? There he is. Great.
The next one is 2017-2018, number 146, transparency in healthcare billing. We'll wait for him to come up.
Does the board want to take 5 minutes?
Sure. We'll just take a break.
That's okay.